Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Please be seated.
Please call the case. Case number SCWC 14-933, State of Hawaii v. Matsumoto. Arguing for the petitioner, David Hayakawa. Arguing for the respondent, Chad Kumagawa. Arguing on the merits.
All right, good evening and aloha, everyone. The court's honored to be here tonight at the William S. Richardson School of Law. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right, and Mr. Kumagawa, you as well?
Yes.
All right, my understanding is that Mr. Hayakawa, you reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a warning light come on with 5 minutes to go in your argument. Mr. Kumagawa will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. Mr. Hayakawa, please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chief Justice Reckenwald, Associate Justices. May it please the court, David Hayakawa here on behalf of defendant appellant Keith Matsumoto. On behalf of Mr. Matsumoto, I thank you for accepting our writ and allowing me here to make this presentation. Our writ raised four issues from the August 29, 2017 summary disposition order from the Intermediate Court. And those four issues being related to the admissibility of defendant's polygraph statement and the follow-up statement, the jury instruction regarding sexual and intimate parts, the use of non-redacted transcripts, and the denial of the motion for judgment of acquittal. I will first address the issue of the admissibility of defendant's polygraph statement and the follow-up statement. The first question, I'm tracking the briefs as well as the intermediate opinion. The first statement is, was this a falsehood? I think it's very easy for people to focus on, well, technically he didn't pass, but that's not the complete picture. If you look at the totality of what was said there and the combination of statements, it clearly was a falsehood. And I'm gonna go through it rather quickly, but I think it is important. First of all, the detective sits down and goes through a process 14 minutes before he even pulls out the first official waiver form because he wants the defendant to have an informed decision about this process. That, he explains that this is a pass-fail test. No mention of inconclusive results. Then the first document he pulls out is an official HPD 34 form. One line of that form specifically states, you will be given the test results at the end of the exam. And defendant signs it, and the detective signs it. Once again, this is an official HPD form. It also says that these test results will be shared with appropriate authorities, more specifically investigators and others whose official duties require them to have this information. The second form he is given is the standard HPD 81 waiver of right forms. And I know the court's aware of that form, but of significance there is it says, anything you say may be used against you at the trial. Common reading of that is, what happened in this polygraph test may be used against you in that trial. Okay? Then he goes through this very detailed process. And again, before he even reaches these waivers, he's already spent 14 minutes with the defendant. Okay? As opposed to usual statements where the very first thing they do is these waiver forms. He clearly, in describing his process, he's creating a bond of trust and essentially explaining to the defendant about this machine. And he's creating confidence in the defendant's mind on this machine.
Can I interrupt you just for a second, Mr. Hayakawa? Because you were focusing on the polygraph waiver form. And I wanted to ask specifically what you are saying the significance is of the language that said, results will be given to me at the end of this examination. Are you suggesting that that was a condition upon which the defendant gave consent, or what is the significance of that?
I believe that it was what he was specifically told in an official HPD form that was going to be the procedure of the test, that he would be told the result of the test.
So your point is he wasn't really told the result.
Correct, and that blends in with those other factors to make it an extrinsic falsehood.
I don't understand when you say he wasn't told the results. I thought he was told the result. The result was he was told it was pass-fail, and he was told he didn't pass. Why isn't that a result?
It's a misleading result, especially when it's combined with a specific statement that says, you didn't pass, and I know you are not telling me the truth, after the detective specifically testified that he was unable to give an opinion as to whether he passed or he failed, that it was in between, he was, quote, unable to render an opinion on the subject. So that clearly is a falsehood when he told them, I know you're not telling me the truth, because he was unable to render that opinion.
Well, if it's a falsehood, is it extrinsic or intrinsic?
It's
please give your analysis on that, because it doesn't really fit within either box if you look at our decisions.
I do understand that. And we believe it's extrinsic as opposed to intrinsic. We believe it is extrinsic because it truly is. When you go to the definition in Kelly-Colio, it does talk about, deliberate falsehoods extrinsic to the facts of the alleged offense. The polygraph result has nothing to do with that the offense itself, which are the type reasonably likely to procure an untrue statement or to influence an accused to make a confession regarding guilt. And we would actually submit to you that even more so than the six factors already cited in Kelly-Colio as extrinsic statements, this one has even, the present case, has even a stronger likelihood of getting an individual to change a story. When a individual is led to believe that scientifically, what you have told me is false. It's not true.
Mr. Hayakawa, you mentioned that there was a problem. Well, I assume that you phrased it, that there was a problem given HPD 81 right after the polygraph warning, because it led him to believe that what he would say during the polygraph test could be used against him. Why is that a problem? How did that prejudice him?
It goes, and again, I do realize the totality test goes to the intrinsic, but I do believe in understanding the overall impact upon him, which satisfies Kelly-Colio, it is a combination of factors. So again, so when he's been thinking, I didn't pass, which we would submit to reasonably, pass, fail, you didn't pass, means you failed. And I know you're not telling me the truth, which is a falsehood. When combined with specifically being told in an official form that authorities and others are going to be told the results of this test, and anything you say here, essentially a reasonable explanation is the results of this test are going to be admissible in your trial. And
well,
you
wait, that's a leap. What you say can be used against you to the results of the test will be used in trial.
I don't dispute that is a leap, but when you look at the overall situation, an individual in custody for hours, he's been given these official forms and he's told to sign them. All they have to do is amend that form. Why use the same form when you're telling somebody everything you say here can be used in your trial? There is a certain plain reading to these things.
Is that a new argument that he confessed because he believed that the results could be utilized against him of the polygraph results could be used at trial? I don't think I came across that.
That was not raised anywhere. I admit it in the process of preparing this and doing a series of mock presentations, that issue did come up.
Well, how is this any different from if the police officer said, you know what, your co-conspirator just said that you did it. Inculpatory statement from a co-conspirator, which is a classic intrinsic statement, right?
Because, yes.
So how is this any different? The machine told me you did it.
It is much different because one is based on fact pattern, and then the defendant can say, well, you know, either I did not, in my own head, I did not do this, or I know what that guy is like. He's not believable. I'm going to stay by something here. As opposed to here, where he's being told, again, scientifically, you've been proven that your statement is false, and I know you're not telling me the truth, which combines on that, and then the follow-up statement, which is, you need to tell me, essentially, we need to hear another story, a story that reasonable people who review the fact pattern of this case will understand.
Well, haven't our extrinsic cases generally been either the defendant has been told that they'll get a benefit or avoid a detriment, and that's the problem with extrinsic statements, because a person may be induced to confess because of either the benefit or avoiding the detriment.
Yes, Kaylee Khalil does discuss that, although I would note the last exception where the detective, the example is, the detective tells the suspect, look, you know, I could lose my job if you don't confess, my wife is pregnant. There's no benefit to the defendant on that.
Well, avoiding a detriment. Yeah, but let me ask you this. Does that case require that a situation be either intrinsic or extrinsic? Is there any requirement?
First of all, we believe under either intrinsic, extrinsic, it should be out by the totality under intrinsic or per se under the Kelly Colio under extrinsic. But we do believe that the follow-up comment about I need essentially something that reasonable people, first of all, who are reasonable people? When you read that in conjunction with the waiver form, it's authorities being told about the outcome of this case, the results of this case. Reasonable people will be told that when they review this case, will understand what happened.
Now, I think Justice Pollack is alluding to this idea about, again, you're talking about in terms of reasonable people, presumably the jury would be considering about a confession. This is a particularly sensitive evidence, right?
Correct.
Confession. And there seems to be a line of cases in Illinois and in Minnesota that suggests by virtue of it being a confession, there's a fundamental right of the defendant to explain the circumstances that surround the confession. So from that point of view, what difference would it make if it was extrinsic or intrinsic?
I agree with the court. I think it's a simple matter of process. If it's extrinsic, you have a per se rule that can knock it out, and we would submit, if you added a seventh category to Kelly Khalil, we'd avoid this one problem in the first place by telling police, just don't mislead somebody on the one thing the jury can't hear about. But if you go to the intrinsic side, with the totality of the side, and essentially I believe in a way that boils down to Crane, you look at it, the impression the jury received about this statement could not have been farther from the truth than almost any example I could think of. It was just crazy. Case in point, the detective testifies that they don't want any distractions in the room. There's no photographs, there's no clock, nothing to distract his one-on-one with the defendant. I mean, what could be farther from the truth? He's hooked up to electrodes and everything else. Then he doesn't take notes for, what is it, three and a half hours. He keeps it all in my head. But again, because of this calm environment, just me and the defendant, it's easy to remember. Plus, we don't want notes or recording devices based on some sort of policy. Nobody can remember why. But maybe because that will distract the defendant. He'll be more self-conscious that people are judging him or watching what he's doing, as opposed to the reality of the situation where the detective is A, watching in the eyes, watching the movement of the hands because that can move the electrodes, monitoring the breathing, watching with, quote, one eye on the screen at all times, all while from memory asking these questions and getting the answers and trying to remember and developing rapport with the defendant. So if you're talking about a misimpression to the jury, that's just the start of it, and we couldn't cross on any of that. There were no contemporaneous notes. And if you even want to multiply...
I'm not entirely sure where you're going with this. You're saying because there weren't contemporaneous notes and because there wasn't a recording, therefore...
We were not allowed to cross the detective on the ridiculousness of his claim that he wanted a sterile environment with no distractions.
But if you were successful in showing that he was being ridiculous, is your point that then your client would have been believed when your client said that he was being, if you will, coerced to make a statement? Is that?
It goes to if allowed into evidence the context of this, that he was misled about that he lied, and then when you combine that he failed, and when you combine that with the I need something that reasonable people will know, otherwise, essentially, you're gonna get charged. That is a reason for him to change his story, which is the centerpiece of Kelly Kalio. He had to say something, and it's even more than that, because, again, the confession to this detective is just clear-cut, it's this clear-cut, solid confession. Yet, of course, there's no notes. Not even the detective McComsey, who's watching through the one-way glass, took any notes on it.
Wait a minute, you're not saying that your client didn't say what he said, right?
He challenged in his testimony the absolute nature that Detective Kuaana described his statement as occurring. But even then, when you look at his, and again, this goes when you talk about Crane, and Crane talks about the one quote, I'm sure the court's aware of this, but the Crane talked of stripped of the power to describe to the jury the circumstances that prompted his confession. The defendant is effectively disabled from answering the one question every rational juror needs answered. If the defendant is innocent, why did he previously admit his guilt? Now, when you look at the confession portion or the admission portions that are recorded, and that's with Detective, I call it part three, with Detective McComsey, it's not, there are a large amount of limiting statements. You see, I've been thinking all night, no way I touched her. Question, you touched and grabbed a little? I'm not gonna say I didn't, let's put it that way. Another answer, I can't really clearly recall that I did, but I'm not gonna say I didn't. I may have grabbed it, probably did. If I did it, I did it. My rule is not to do it, okay? And paraphrasing a little bit, he was very clear that he had no recall of any touching when he gave the first statement. And he goes on to say, the whole last night, all I was thinking about was, did I touch her butt after we did knuckles? Another statement. So all last night, I kept thinking, oh, did I? And I swore, no, I didn't touch her. You have a lot of limitations that if this jury was made aware that he was 100% consistent about his story until he was told about this polygraph, that he had failed, he had not passed, and the detective...
Mr. Hayakawa, so how far do you think the party should have been allowed to go in talking about the polygraph? So once that door is open, like, there's a very strong rule that we follow that polygraph results can't come in state or defense. So once that door is open, how can the court limit, for example, getting into the accuracy of polygraphs, expert testimony from the defense about what it means to be inconsistent? How far do you think it's fair to go, and how could the judge have kept that under control without undermining those concerns?
First of all, I want to make something clear. The defense is not saying the best solution to this problem is to make an exception to Chang. That this is a Pandora's box. That you look at some of these cases, essentially mainland cases allow bringing in a outside polygraph expert. And of course, in this case, that the key to that one was they were able to look at a videotape and totally rip it apart. However, there's no videotape here, which is crazy, but extremely unusual.
You mean videotape with respect to which interview? You're talking about
the polygraph.
Polygraph?
So you can see if the individual is moving his hand when the screen jumps, if he coughs, all these things that can impact.
So what should the defendant have been allowed
to do? Well, first of all, we believe the court should have not allowed the whole test in, period. We should not have allowed the statement in when they use that lie. However, if they do, unfortunately, opening up that Pandora's box, it does allow the defense to bring in, first of all, that to have an independent review of these charts, to have their expert come in and say what these charts mean, and for the defendant to describe what he was told and how this made him react.
You mean the charts of the results of the exam?
Yes.
Why would you allow, those charts have never been admissible. Why would you allow the examination by defense experts of evidence that's not admissible?
Again, we don't want this, but when the state chooses to, the police choose to pick to mislead the defendant on the one area that they know a jury's not allowed to hear about, what solution do we have left under Crane?
Well, there's two solutions, or two parts of it. I think the first one is, what Crane says is basically you have to allow in all the circumstances surrounding the confession so the fact finder can determine what they said. Why would a person who confessed to something they didn't do? So you have to allow. And the second thing, you give a limiting instruction and you tell the jury that what the evidence has only been a limited, it doesn't go to guilt, but it only goes to the weight and effect of the confession that they've received. So that you don't have to get into these documents that you do, you know, these, as Justice Nakayama just mentioned, there's no reason to go there.
But I understand that your initial argument is that this was an extrinsic falsehood and therefore none of this comes in afterwards, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so you are arguing for a rule that says that if law enforcement states a falsehood about the results of a polygraph test, any confession that is made thereafter is inadmissible. Is that correct?
Correct.
So you would say that that would extend to infinity, forever? Any confession at any time, even if the confession is made 3 months later?
I would assume we would use the same, I will admit I am not versed on that line of cases, the existing case law about delayed confessions and how Miranda applies to those and everything else and the long-term effect of fruit of the poisonous tree. But once somebody confesses using coercive techniques, we would, to me the fallback is yes, it's not admissible.
No, I think what Justice McCann is asking, let's suppose you falsified the polygraph results, person didn't make a response at that point in time, a month later, after the person's released, the person makes a statement.
I'm not sure.
Fair enough.
But in this case, correct me if I'm not misunderstanding the record, didn't the trial judge say that there could be reference to the fact that the polygraph examiner made statements that were not totally truthful?
That's we were allowed to bring up that you told defendant something not, quote, not totally true, with no other information.
So are you suggesting that it would be inappropriate for the trial judge to tailor in any way how it is the defendant explains the circumstances under which he decided or she decided to give a confession?
I imagine, again, I would echo what Justice Pollack described as procedures that have been used in these other cases following Crane, which is the defendant can bring in the circumstances and what was told to him about what occurred and therefore explain, this is why I changed my story. So I don't know how we would tailor that necessarily.
But you could, one could do that and not get into the merits of polygraphs or accuracy. I mean, what you're saying is the defendant should have been able to elicit what in fact happened, and then that would be the limit.
Well, I do note that one case allowed them to bring in the expert who said, no, this individual didn't, he passed.
But that was because in that case what had happened is the polygraph examiner told the defendant that she had failed.
Correct.
And so the defense put on an expert. So not only that the information was wrong, but actually the polygraph had misread the results and that the person had passed. So I'm not sure that that's a similar situation.
Well, first of all, I do agree. At the very least, we would use the basic process that Justice Pollack discussed, where he does inconclusive, but I told him he didn't pass, and all the basic things come in, and then he says, without putting on all the experts to say accuracy, or we studying this test result shows that you really did pass or not, or because that opens an incredible another door. But you give the limiting instruction that says, you know, polygraphs.
I'm so sorry, we can't do photography in the, sorry, polygraph.
to give a limiting instruction saying that, again, I don't have the exact quote, but it's been used here, that polygraphs are not admissible, they're not scientifically reliable, but again, the defendant can explain and the jury can then understand the actual context of what's going on, that how distracted the detective could have been, and as well as many other factors. I mean, I could point out basic cross-examination that we were not allowed to do because the magic words polygraph or an explanation of the process that was going on.
Can you address the jury instruction issue?
Yes. We believe that the defense proposed 3 accurately reflects the language of the existing case law. And, excuse me, under Silva. And that the state's, the court's instruction does not. In fact, a reading of the court's instruction is intimate parts means buttocks. And it goes on to say some other things, but period. So the jury is being instructed that a buttock is an intimate part.
Why did the instruction select buttocks? I mean, aside from maybe other issues, what's the selective use of deciding that that's the one that it said intimate part means buttocks? Under the circumstances of this case, it seems like it's selecting certain evidence.
I would agree very strongly with that. I would suggest that politically correct. We had a very strong-willed trial judge who made some very specific decisions on how things were going to be. And both myself and my very experienced opposing counsel worked very hard, whether it be the transcripts and the videotape and everything else, to prepare the case to follow the specific guidelines laid down by this judge.
Sir, I understand your point that this seems like a direct connection with that language in the jury instruction. Intimate parts means the buttocks, which
right.
would perhaps suggest that as long as there's a contact with buttocks, it's an intimate part. But how do you respond to the qualifying language that was included that says, in considering whether the part of the body touched is a sexual or other intimate part, you must consider the context in which the contact occurred. Why isn't that a sufficient qualifier to allow the jury to consider the context in which the touching took place to determine whether it's an intimate part or not?
Because the jury can, especially when they read this, say to themselves, okay, the buttocks is an intimate part. Now, there's other parts of the body that may have been touched here. We can look at context to decide if those parts apply, are qualify under this definition. That's why the defense definition and the language of the case law says very clearly, a body part might be a sexual or other intimate part in one context and might not be in the other. It gives the jury the specific knowledge that it is up to them to determine if this is an intimate part, given the context of the situation.
What does context mean here? Is it the location? Is it the touching? Is it everything? Is it both? I mean, what is...
But this goes back, actually, this is actually the specific example given in Silver. Is this an attaboy pat, or is this a sexualized contact of a minor's buttocks? And that's up to the jury to decide. But it was taken away from them when they're told, period, intimate parts means buttocks.
Does instruction include anything about sexual connotations? I mean, isn't that what Kalani says?
One moment, please. The actual instruction says... I lost my train of thought, Justice.
Right. I think it seems that Kalani says that, although perhaps buttocks can be an intimate part, the statutes are intended to regulate, only prohibit contact with sexual connotations.
Correct.
Where in the instructions is that included? That the context has to be a sexual connotation.
In other words, Justice McKenna's point is that the way it's written, it says intimate parts means buttocks, and there's no correlation that there has to be a relationship, as Silver says there has to be sexual connotation or an association with sexual relations or something, and there's no, that was my question, are we
having
any context?
Yes, thank you very much. I got a little lost there. Yes, that's why, again, we believe that the proposed three by the defense addresses these issues, how a body part might be a sexual or other intimate part in one context and may not be in the other. And the court's instruction is minimized and sterilized.
Mr. Hayakawa, you're into your rebuttal time. Did you want to reserve that time?
Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Kumagai, you're on.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Chad Kumagai, on behalf of Respondent Appellee, State of Hawaii. Your Honors, there may be an appropriate case where the admission of polygraph results may be permitted. However, this is not that case based on the record before the court.
He's not asking for the polygraph results to be admitted. He's asking for the circumstances surrounding his second statement, which include falsifying the results of them.
Well,
so he's not asking for the results.
In order to convey to the jury, as the petitioner is asking, that misrepresentation, the jury would necessarily have to be told what the result of the polygraph is so that they know that it is in fact the misrepresentation. If the jury is just told that the defendant did not pass and that was a misrepresentation, that in of itself would tell the jury that what the result of the polygraph is.
Is there a difference between pass and fail and inconclusive? Inconclusive is kind of like he didn't even take the test.
Well, I think that the petitioner correctly cited a document that relates that there are other reasons other than did not score low enough to fail, did not score high enough to pass, that could lead to an inconclusive result.
Would you concede it was deceptive?
I wouldn't concede that it's deceptive, Your Honor, because I still think that based on the motion to suppress testimony by Detective Kuana, he said that the inconclusive result was based on the score.
You think from the defendant and his point of view, given everything that Mr. Hayakawa mentioned, would draw the reasonable inference that he was being told he'd failed the test? Isn't that at least a reasonable inference that he could have drawn?
It is, Your Honor. But if the court is asking about deceptive misrepresentations in the context of a Kelly-Kolio argument, Kelly-Kolio seems to require a degree of scienter. In other words, that...
Are you saying that the detective didn't intentionally mislead the Mr. Matsumoto?
Yes, Your Honor. In the motion to suppress, Detective Kuana testified that he believed that the did not pass was the equivalent of the inconclusive result.
Can I read to you from his response?
Yes.
There is a part of my pretest that I explain to them, and this is where I go over the polygraph and how it works. After I explain to them how it works, I then explain to them how do they pass the test. It's at that time that I inform them that this is a pass-fail test. Either you pass or you don't. I see. And so when I render my result in layman's terms, he did not pass the test. How is that not deceptive?
Your Honor, I think there are also portions in Detective Kuana's testimony during the motion to suppress, such as when he's asked, when he says, I told him he did not pass the test, that he did not pass the test. Question, is that accurate? Answer, very much so.
Well, we're not talking about whether or not it's accurate. It's the question of whether or not he had an intent to deceive the defendant to lead him to believe that he failed it.
Yes.
And you're saying that Detective Kuana did not intend to deceive him into thinking that he failed the exam?
That's what the record suggests, Justice Nakayama.
So therefore, your argument, would you concede that if he had, let's say that Mr. Matsumoto had actually passed, and if the detective had said, you failed, you would concede that any confession thereafter would not be admissible?
I wouldn't concede that, because I think that still goes to...
So you think that's intrinsic and not extrinsic?
Yes, I do, because it speaks to the defendant's...
So therefore, if we adopt that argument, that means that in every case that the police falsely tell the defendant that they failed the polygraph when they actually passed, your position would be that the defendant cannot come in and say that I falsely confessed because I was told that I failed.
He could absolutely say that, but that would be for the court to consider in the totality of the circumstances whether that confession was voluntary or not.
Doesn't our cases say that intrinsic falsehood include misrepresentations regarding the existence of incriminating evidence, such as lies about the discovery of non-existent witnesses or physical evidence? How can a lie subsequent to the event fit in that category?
Because it goes to the defendant's credibility. In other words,
so anything that goes to the defendant's credibility is intrinsic?
I'm not saying that anything that goes to the defendant's credibility could be intrinsic. However, in this case, with the record before the court, the misrepresentation, assuming arguendo that it is a misrepresentation and deliberate at that, would be intrinsic, especially considering the fact that the defendant was told that he did not pass, and the results were inconclusive.
So
I think this...
Go through your analysis of the intrinsic analysis, then, totality of the circumstances. The detective, like you said, assume the detective intentionally lied to him. Assume that he meant to have him believe that he didn't pass the exam. Assume that all the other things he said to him, which may or may not be okay in other situations. How does, if you do your intrinsic analysis, how does the totality of the circumstances come up to admitting the evidence?
Because the totality of the circumstances show that the defendant was a well-educated man who had a civil and urban engineering degree from the University of Pennsylvania. He had an MBA from the University of Michigan. He ran his own business. He held high positions in high school athletics. And looking at the third statement itself, watching the video as the trial court did, it's clear that the defendant's world was clearly not rocked, as the petitioner would characterize it. The defendant gave narrative responses. He made denials at appropriate times, such as when the detective asked him if he had touched the complainant anywhere in the front or the crotch area. The defendant denied those things. He gave long descriptions about certain things. He smiled at times. He laughed with the detective. He even made a joke about the...
Mr. Kumiga, aren't you focusing on issues that pertain to voluntariness? In other words, is it your conclusion that once the statement is found to be voluntary, that it cannot be admissible for another purpose, such as the credibility of the particular confession? In other words, under Crane, if an individual gives a confession, but it's cold, gives a confession and there are circumstances that seem to be circumstances that would incline a defendant to want to be released by giving a confession, that's admissible, right? The defendant can speak about that during the course of testimony, correct?
If there's evidence to support the fact that it actually influences state.
So in this case,
so
the defendant could get up and talk about at least the fact that it was cold, I had to wait over 8 hours, and I had my contacts dry up so that my cornea was hurting. That would be all right, right?
Correct.
And Crane doesn't just speak to the physical circumstances. Crane also speaks to the psychological circumstances. So why wouldn't this qualify as a psychological circumstance? In other words, I'm taking a polygraph examination. There isn't even a recording of it. And over again, police officer is lying to me. And this is an atmosphere that I find very coercive, and I just want to get it over with because I can see, you know, I'm dealing with somebody I can't trust. Why wouldn't that be relevant to the circumstances surrounding the confession to the jury that has to decide what kind of weight to give to the confession? Why is it's that much different than the defendant saying it was oppressive because of the physical circumstances? He's saying it's oppressive because of the psychological circumstances where you've got this police officer that's lying. And making me say, which would be, you know, part of, I guess, the point that's being made by the defense, this police officer is suggesting that I'm saying something I'm not, right? Because in his testimony, the defendant says the police officer was saying that I admitted to touching another woman or another girl 2 weeks beforehand. The police officer was saying to me that I did admit that I actually grabbed the complaining witness's buttocks. And during the course of the defendant's testimony for the motion to suppress, he's continually saying these are statements that are being said that aren't true. So consistent with that, wouldn't it make sense that he would be able to say, and then he lied to me about the whole polygraph. He said he'd give me the results, and the results he gave me were actually a lie.
Because based on this record, the polygraph results were not material and relevant to his third statement. He had two opportunities in which he could have said, you know, I don't understand how.
It might be difficult.
Can I read you what he said? Based in part, and this is part quoted, based on this misleading or inaccurate information, he testified that he started doubting what he could recall. So he specifically testified that those statements affected his ability to recollect, and based upon what he had remembered, whether it was accurate. So it did affect him. That evidence was there.
But right after the second statement, the defendant made a third statement to Detective McComsey, and the first thing that came up was the polygraph test, but not in the context of it changed what I have to say. It was, I was shown the diagram during the polygraph statement, and that's what jogged my mind. And later, during the motion to suppress, no mention of the effect of the polygraph test upon the defendant, why he chose to make a statement, why his story changed from the first statement. And so, Your Honor, it is true that Crane does allow a defendant to present competent and reliable evidence, but that
in psychological.
Wait a minute, excuse me. When you say it allows them to present reliable, in other words, someone makes a decision beforehand whether they're going to admit the evidence, I thought what Crane says is that the defendant's allowed to present all the circumstances surrounding the statement. There's nobody who's going to be making a predetermination whether that evidence is reliable. The defendant's allowed to tell what happened.
But this case is different because there were two instances in which the defendant, first he told Detective McComsey what happened, no mention of the polygraph effect, he had the motion to suppress.
I just read to you what he did testify that it did influence, and he began to question his recall, and in fact, the thing that you just mentioned about the map, that came after he had been told. This all occurred after he had been told directly by the police officer that he had lied. That he wasn't telling the truth, essentially.
So isn't this the distinctions between whether or not it influenced him? Is that for the trier of fact to take a look at?
Not in this case, Your Honor. Given that the record before, prior to the trial. And I would also like to add that this Crane discussion, this constitutional argument, was not presented to the trial court. In essence, what the trial court was told is that there are these line of cases that say no polygraph evidence may be admitted, but it nonetheless asked the court to present the polygraph.
They didn't cite Kalei Kaeilo?
Not at all, Your Honor.
That case was never cited in the trial court.
Not before the trial court, Your Honor. And I think this becomes especially relevant based on Justice Nakayama's recent concurrence in Castro v. Melchor, in which the party presentation principle came up. And I think especially for the trial court, it wasn't the trial court's role to sally forth and make a constitutional argument.
Are you saying that there was a waiver by the defense of being able to talk about this, of inquire into the circumstances of his state, of his second and third statements?
I'm saying that the constitutional argument was not raised before the...
Okay, so you're arguing it was a waiver, but putting aside the you call a constitutional argument, wasn't the defendant arguing that he should be able to inquire of the officer who administered the polygraph exam that, hey, you told me I hadn't passed, isn't it true that in fact it was inconclusive? Weren't those the kinds of questions the defendant wanted to ask?
Yes.
Okay. But you think that's a waiver because he didn't cite Kelly Colio?
I'm looking at the motion and it cites Kelly Colio.
I think the trial judge actually in his findings of fact mentioned Crane.
I'm speaking about the polygraph results, the defendant's first motion in limine, where he specifically asked for the polygraph results. No constitutional case law was raised at that point in that motion. The motion to suppress was...
His findings of fact and conclusions of law that pertain to the motion to suppress directly address Kelly Colio.
And that related to the voluntariness, which is different from the results of the polygraph test.
But he's not asking for the results. We're asking for the circumstances surrounding the inaccurate polygraph results that were provided to the defendant.
I understand that statement, but as I said, in order to tell the context of the supposed misrepresentation to the defendant, the true polygraph results must be presented in order to make it clear that there actually was a misrepresentation on behalf of Detective Kua'ana.
You know, you're arguing for a rule, as I understand, that you can lie to the defendant about polygraph results, sort of coerce or induce a confession or a false confession for that matter, and because we have this rule that says polygraph results can't be admitted, therefore you keep everything out regarding the polygraph? In other words, isn't that some sort of encouragement for the police to lie about it because you're saying that it can't come in? Is that the argument?
The argument is that if there was a case where it was clear that the defendant was influenced by a supposed misrepresentation related to the polygraph results, then at that point, there very well be.
End of your argument, I'm so sorry to interrupt, I just want to be sure I get it, is that you don't believe, you think the record shows he wasn't influenced. If we were to conclude that the record showed the contrary, then you would concede that there was a improper limit placed on his cross-examination?
No, well, to be frank, Mr. Chief Justice, I haven't thought that far out, but
I'm trying to understand, do you think the limits on his, if we were to conclude that in fact this issue wasn't waived and that in the circumstances the statement was made to him were misleading, at that point, what is your position regarding the permissibility of the limits that the trial court placed on the defendant's cross-examination? As I understand it, the defendant was only allowed to elicit comments to the along the lines of he was told something inaccurate, I believe, not completely accurate. So that's what the limit was. Is that, if your position is that was fair, could you explain to us how that was fair?
It was fair because the defendant was allowed to say that he was told something that wasn't completely true. Detective Kua'ana testified as to his interrogation techniques, the change in his tone, the accusatory nature of the third phase, although they didn't use that term during trial. And so in this case, the jury was fully informed of the tactics that Detective Kua'ana employed. And
I hear that argument, the jury was completely informed and they never heard about the polygraph, and we think the polygraph is so influential, we keep it out of a normal case when the results are that's all there is. So it's kind of like the argument, in a way, rebuts itself, because the fact of a polygraph under our law is so influential that we don't let the results in, and you're saying the jury was fully informed, even though he was lied about it, and we're saying we're not going to tell the jury.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's, I mean, it...
Don't you think that polygraph evidence is different from other types of falsehoods?
No, Your Honor. And especially in this case, where there are other cases where the defendant is told that he failed when he, in fact he passed. It's not completely inaccurate that the defendant did not pass, because in fact he did not pass. And as Detective Kuana testified, it wasn't because of an error with the machine or anything like that. He just did not score high enough to pass.
But he was told it was a pass-fail, and he was also told that if he failed, that there would be an interrogation after, and therefore, and he was interrogated after. So isn't that also telling him that he failed?
Well, yeah, that's correct, Justice McKenna.
But isn't that, Justice McKenna's point, isn't that the reason the trial judge said that the jury could be informed through the testimony of Detective Kuana that what he said was untrue? You see my point? It does appear that the trial judge was convinced that the record supported the statement that the detective engaged in statements that were not totally truthful. And once you concede that, the trial judge found that there were tactics being used that were totally untruthful, why then wouldn't it follow that the jury ought to be given some idea what this untruthful behavior is that pertains to the detective's, you know, conduct with the defendant?
I don't believe that the record indicates that the court did find that it was untruthful. It did go through an intrinsic analysis.
But the court, don't you agree the court allowed that the statement could be made, that Detective Kuana, court determined and ruled that Detective Kuana could testify only that he made a statement that was not true, totally untruthful, right?
I agree that the...
I'm interested in your clarification, because if you look at the findings of fact of the judge actually determines that the statements were truthful.
Correct.
So, is this a reason for us to find that the findings of fact and conclusions of law are arbitrary?
No, Your Honor, I think that's the trial...
Are these conflicting?
That is the trial court allowing the defendant to present evidence of what the defendant believed was a misrepresentation. And that's what it was doing in that instance. The court's findings that the detective was not being untruthful stands on its own.
Do you think it's different if a detective tells the defendant, you know, John Doe identified you as the perpetrator, and the guy is like, I was in Nevada then. I mean, no, it's not going to induce me to confess. But if the detective said, your lie detector test came out that you were lying, don't you think that would have a different effect on the defendant?
It may. It very well may. However...
So the lies, what the lie is different, right? Just to say, well, I'm allowed to say that I was told a falsehood. The nature of the falsehood has to matter to the finder of fact. Or the trier of fact, I should say.
I think in this case, the nature of the falsehood was... the jury was informed of the misrepresentation, and under the existing case law, based on the evidentiary arguments that were presented to the trial court, I think that was the best that the trial court could have done in that situation.
Let's assume there it was a falsehood. And if it was a falsehood, then we've in the past relied on this extrinsic versus intrinsic. It appears that these facts don't fit neatly within either. But isn't the purpose of the extrinsic test that says these are the kinds of falsehoods that lead to false confessions? Doesn't that, but those kinds of, what we have found to be extrinsic has basically been more along the lines of statements that would provide benefits to the defendant if he confessed. That's not the situation here. But the policy that says for extrinsic falsehoods, the statement doesn't come in, it's because the falsehood tends to encourage false confessions. Isn't telling a defendant that he failed the polygraph exam one of those types of falsehoods? Isn't that a pretty strong falsehood that might lead to false confessions?
Not in the context of this case, Your Honor, and the record before the court, because the third statement with Detective McComsey was videotaped. The court can see for itself the fact that the defendant didn't have his world rocked. He is just...
So the trial court makes credibility determinations, and even though the defendant says, hey, being told that I failed the polygraph exam, which is how I construed the detective statement, really affected me and made me think maybe my recollection was incorrect. The judge can disregard that, draw the credibility determination, and say, no, you don't get to say that.
Based on what it was presented to it.
So the judge makes credibility determination of important facts that might influence a jury.
I've been under the impression that the admissibility is by the judge and the weight and effect goes to the fact finder, which means that all the surrounding circumstances have to be provided so the jury can determine what the weight and effect is.
But
can I ask you, I can do a brief response, but can you also go to the jury instruction issue as well, please?
With respect to the first point, Justice Paula, the admissibility is determined by the court. And for the evidence to be admissible, it must be material and relevant, and that wasn't the case here, based on what was presented to the court.
Excuse me, the evidence has to be, that's a test for admissibility, material? I don't think so. I don't think relevancy is whether the evidence can lead to, a consequential fact in the case. The weight in effect allows, under Crane and Arro case law, allows all the circumstances surrounding the confession to be admitted.
But even Crane qualifies the admissibility of the evidence based that the and requires that the evidence be competent and reliable.
Right.
So there is some
competence
qualification.
Goes to personal knowledge, whether the witness has personal knowledge about what they're testifying to, whether the witness is competent in terms of the ability to testify, but there's no materiality test.
And Crane specifically refers to the psychological environment of the confession.
And
in the psychological environment of the confession, well, help me with this, Mr. Kumagai. Maybe you're suggesting we just should reject the analysis from People versus Milok in Illinois, where there was a finding that it was a fundamental right to a fair opportunity to present a defense for a defendant to be able to supply the circumstances surrounding a polygraph and to admit evidence of polygraph to say this is why I confessed. And there were no allegations that the officer lied during the course of the polygraph, but nonetheless it was found that that's a fundamental right, along with, and it cited Crane making the point that a psychological circumstance that pertains to a confession, you could very well argue that's a powerful one, is that there's been a polygraph that suggested to the defendant that there was an opinion of somebody that he wasn't telling the truth or she wasn't telling the truth.
Well, Your Honor, all of these polygraph tests must turn on their own facts. And in this case...
Are we to reject the analysis of People versus Milok, where there wasn't even an issue about the police misrepresenting the results of the polygraph?
No, Your Honor, but that's not what the petitioner is arguing here. The petitioner is arguing that the polygraph result had effect on the defendant, but that's just not supported by the record. So, Your Honors, as I said,
I'm not sure how, this is interesting, and maybe you can help me with this analysis of the record. HPD has a process by which, and rightfully so, a recording is made when a defendant is confessing, right?
Correct.
In this case, the defendant enters into a conversation with the detective pursuant to a waiver, the HPD form, that is a specific waiver, as I understand it, 374, for a polygraph examination. So
correct.
The polygraph examination happens. Maybe you can explain why it isn't recorded like the other interviews, but anyways, it's not recorded. And then it transitions into an interview, but not an interview that's recorded. So the defendant doesn't get the benefit, the jury doesn't get the benefit of a recording for this area of interview. Why is that? Why are you contending that this waiver for a polygraph covers a process that doesn't seem to involve the polygraph? It's the polygraph examiner then asking questions of the defendant about whether he's telling the truth and suggesting that he wasn't.
I can't, Justice Wilson, I can't tell you why the polygraph exam, the subsequent questioning, is not recorded, but I can tell you that Detective Kuana testified that the defendant could stop with him at any time. If he wanted an attorney, he could stop at any time. But
well, if that's your test, that's an easy one. If we just accept what the government's going to say. I mean, you have a defendant that's saying, during this conversation, the police officer keeps telling me that I said something that I didn't. And they're very incriminating statements, like that he actually did grab the buttocks of the complaining witness and that he did engage in inappropriate behavior with another female. I mean, I know you're saying that the detective didn't agree with that, but...
Well, Justice Wilson, if you're referring to the motion to suppress proceedings, the court made a specific finding that the defendant's recitation of the events were not credible and that the detectives were. So, Your Honors, there may well be a case in which the polygraph results should be admitted. Under the facts of this case, this is not that case.
Do you want to briefly address, your time is up, but we were asking you questions there in your last few minutes. Would you like to briefly address the jury instructions, and then any further, again, very briefly wrap up if you have anything else?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. With respect to the jury instruction, the juries are instructed that they must read all of the instructions as a whole. So given the instruction that, quote, in considering whether the part of the body touched is a sexual or other intimate part, you must consider the context in which the contact occurred. Based on that instruction, it should have been clear to the jury that there are contexts in which the sexual contact of the buttocks would be qualified as sexual contact and other contexts in which it would not. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kumaga. Mr. Hayakawa, your rebuttal.
Thank you. First of all, I do believe that the defense did preserve their objections. The trial judge did run a very tight ship, and there were specific in limine discussions, and we tried to get material misrepresentations. We were denied that term.
Mr. Hayakawa, in further to the Chief Justice's question before, according to Mr. Kumaga, we're going to have to go into results of polygraph exams, because in order to say that it was not deceptive, in order to say that he lied to him, you have to say he was not deceptive. So where do you draw the line on the results of polygraph exams?
Again, I believe this is a Pandora's box. Well, in this case, it's simple because the detective himself says it was inconclusive, and so that comes in with all the other contexts and statements, and then you that does not present the need then to present to dueling experts on the reliability of polygraphs and that things. Although I do note, I don't think it's in the record here, but there are computer score sheets generated on all these on these polygraph tests. They're not turned over in discovery, but they are generated.
So only inconclusive results, as far as you're concerned, should be admitted?
No, I do not believe so. I believe that, first of all, this is an issue that I do realize it's a first impression issue, but this issue is going to be coming up more and more. I am very confident, and it is. It is the use of these polygraphs and how they, under Crane, how they impact individuals. I believe this case is more of an extrinsic one, but then as the case is cited by the justice talks about, even if you fail, the defense can bring it in to say, look, they told me I failed, and polygraph operator says, yeah, you failed. But that is why I said this. And it gives at least a fighting chance to the defense to explain where they're at. So I don't know where this process ends, which is why I'm suggesting, at least in this one, we call it extrinsic. I do want to say that whether you go extrinsic, intrinsic, totality, or even get down to Crane, the way that it happened in this case clearly, just across the board, denied the defendant a right to confront, denied the right to present a full and fair defense, denied the jury their duty to have a complete understanding of what occurred so they could judge credibility and the weight of evidence. All that was off the table by the methodology and how this came down to when all their
people. Thank you. Oh, Mr. I'm sorry, Justice Wilson. You are
yes.
Over your time, but if Justice Wilson has a question.
I'm sorry, you provoked me to ask the question. You described the kind of violations of the rights of your client, but you know, there was a lot of evidence in this case, right? You had the Bradford coach testify, you had the complaining witness testify, so I was just wondering why this, if it is error, is not harmless.
Well, I do want to stress here that the state's case would have been crushed without this polygraph. We had, at the very least, an eyewitness who was right there next to when the whole thing happened. Even more importantly, and again, this is a very bold statement, but the record backs it up. The three main witnesses, CW, she's a minor, CW, CW's mother, and the coach, within their statements themselves, were completely inconsistent at every single level. The coach is denying he wrote something down, and when he was confronted, he said, well, I was rushed. And then, even when an individual makes a statement, outside witnesses, such as the police officers responding, they're inconsistent with those. They're inconsistent with each other.
Mr. Hayakawa, we've read the record,
yeah,
so
yeah.
If you want to
anyway,
kind of bring
answering,
it to a conclusion, that would be great.
It was not harmless. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Thank you so much to our attorneys. The court will take this matter.